Hello and welcome. This is an interview with Larry Dossey, MD, about his book One Mind. This is brought to you by Greg Meyerhoff and Ann Salisbury. Remind you that this is copyrighted material and is published by Lively Spirit and Go Intuition. For further information, you can find us on the web at gointuition.com.
Great. So, Larry, it is wonderful to have you here today to talk to us about your book, One Mind, how our individual mind is part of a greater consciousness and why it matters. And just to start with, how would you define one mind?
Well, first of all, Ann and Greg, it's really nice to be chatting with you today, and I thank you for having me on.
Sure.
The one mind is an idea which I think helps explain the nature of human consciousness. The basic proposition is that although we experience ourselves as single minds and single bodies, there's a deeper reality in which all minds interconnect. We can get an appreciation of this in certain behaviors and practices such as sitting down, getting quiet, and entering a meditative state. We also get a hint under certain experiences such as ESP, telepathy, clairvoyance, and so on, where minds can exchange information at great distances, and we can even acquire information in the future through intuition and premonitions and so on. So I think it's fundamental to come up with an idea that we're all interconnected, because first of all, it fits our experience, and it certainly fits the experiments that have been done to test this idea. And beyond that, I think it's important because I believe that unless we arrive at some idea of a common unity and connectedness among peoples all over the earth and with other animals and plants and so on, I don't think we have much of a chance of meeting the great challenges that confront us as a human species. So the point I want to make is that when we talk about the one mind, we're really talking beyond pure philosophy. We're talking about, in my judgment, life and death issues which confront us on the planet at this particular moment.
Well, now, when I was little, I was pretty telepathic.
Yeah.
So I have memories of being at church, you know, downstairs where all the adults would take coffee. And I would just think I was having a conversation in my mind with the adults around us. And they would be saying things like, oh, those children, they shouldn't run around so much. Or, you know, they would be having these opinions. And then when they'd open their mouths and speak, they'd say things like, oh, what a pretty dress you have on today. Mm-hmm. And I would think to myself, why is this adult lying to me? This adult just said this other thing, which I heard in my head, and now what's coming out of their mouth is not the same. So with the one mind idea, I believe everybody is telepathic. They may have turned it off at some point, but we all have that ability. That's that connectedness. And some people say, oh, but you shouldn't want to know what other people are thinking. That's private. But I don't think anything's private. I think we're all connected. What do you think on
well,
that?
Well, I totally agree with you. It's interesting that these experiences date to your childhood. We ought to pay more attention to these things in children, but we've created a kind of a stigma, a social stigma, where we discourage children from talking like this. I think that children are naturally telepathic, as you suggest. They don't know, they haven't learned that you're not supposed to have these experiences. You know, as you point out, we adults think we can hide behind this facade of privacy. There is no privacy in the one mind. I think it's a damn good thing that there isn't, because you can look at this as some sort of invasion of privacy, or you can turn that upside down and say sharing thoughts and combining our wisdom and knowledge is one of our best paths forward. So I think it's best to look on the bright side. But you are right. Most of us learn to shut it off around the age of 8 or 10 or something like that. But I'm on a crusade to make these shared experiences more widely known, and for reasons that I've already mentioned.
Good.
And it is interesting because people think we don't know what's going on with them, but within seconds of meeting somebody, you usually know if you like them or not. And you usually know when you're watching somebody, especially on TV, that either they're lying or they're not telling the truth or there's something going on by body language. So it's really, we're seeing it, but it's a little bit more subtle, and people don't think we notice that. But you notice it right away.
Yeah, that's a really good example. You know, a lot of my belief in the value of connectedness between minds comes from my experience in hospitals and taking care of sick people. I have worked for decades with nurses, and I regard nurses as one of the most talented, premonition-prone occupations that exist. I've known nurses who just have a sixth sense about which patients on the ward are going to have trouble during their shift. And I have known actually one secretary on the ward who had this gift of knowing who was going to get into trouble and who wasn't. And she partnered up with a head nurse, and before the shift began, she would take the nurse aside and say, "Pay special attention to that guy in room 10 because I think he's going to have a cardiac arrest in the next few hours." And they did this trade-off for many years, and they were private about it because they thought they would both get fired if it became public. And this is a tragedy. We ought to be honoring our ability to peek into the private lives of other people and use it for good. I understand why people are really nervous about having their privacy invaded, but looking on the dark side is one of the negative ways of approaching this. I think this ability to tap into other people's consciousness and share their thoughts and intentions is an incredibly benevolent gift from the universe, and we ought to take advantage of it.
Well, it's the way it's meant to be, right?
Right.
I mean, we're all meant to help, be able to help each other, because some people, I mean, let's face it, it's harder to see yourself than it is to see another.
Yes.
Because of the perspective thing.
Right.
And you wrote a lot about perspective. What somebody can see as negative, somebody else can see as positive. And how you were defining, you know, when you have black and white in religion, let's say, it's harder to move ahead into the one mind idea, because really, let's face it, everything is, it's on the continuum. And so there would be more gray than black or white. Those would be on the edges, right?
Right.
And the more we give thanks for learning from, let's say, more the dark side, then you can become brighter at the light side. And then as you appreciate the dark side, instead of rejecting those who have shadow aspects in them, because let's face it, we all do, then you love them, and then they can become more comfortable with themselves and grow and change.
So. Well, that's beautifully put. I think if we look around the world, we can see that this cult of individualism has become pathological in an extreme degree. Most of the disagreements that we have on the planet today have to do with people separated into their individual boxes in terms of religion, politics, and so on, and it's become tribalized. I don't think we're going to do a very good job in the future meeting extreme challenges like environmental degradation, global climate change, and on, to say nothing of endless wars of choice, unless we arrive at a point where we can deeply sense our connectedness with one another. I think that this global change in consciousness of unity is going to be absolutely necessary if we're going to survive in any meaningful sense as citizens of this planet.
Right. And the kind of opposite of that, which we see in our practice a lot, because, you know, we have an intuitive consulting business. We're clairvoyant and all that. And a lot of our clients come to us with a codependent background.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times when they hear that you need to be of service to others, they're already way far in that direction.
Yep.
And they need to come more back to the middle, set some boundaries, establish a sense of self some more. Because as you know, in transpersonal psychology, you have to gain a sense of self before you can lose it and join more the perspective of the one mind. And so it's tricky because you have people who are so like in their egos and they've got the right and the other people are wrong. And then you've got the people who've been the caregivers, a lot of nurses, who will overgive.
Right.
And they need to set a boundary where it's kind of like you have your universe, you create in your universe, and then you join the bigger universe. I see it kind of like, you know those Russian dolls?
Oh, sure.
They're so funny. I know, whoever came up with that idea. But so you've got a Russian doll, and it's like everything is within a bigger picture. You know, the microcosm is a part of the macrocosm, and it just keeps unfolding.
You know, what this reminds me of is a concept that came out of quantum physics toward the early days of the 20th century from Niels Bohr, who was awarded a Nobel Prize in physics for coming up with this idea. It's the principle of complementarity. And basically it says that you sometimes have to have conflicting viewpoints before you can have a total understanding of a problem. He was talking about electrons behaving both as a particle and a wave, which obviously doesn't make any logical sense, but that's what the experiments show. So it's often not one or the other, but both. And I think, as you just pointed out, when we look at human personality, individualism is not a bad thing. But if you regard it as one side of the coin, that's going overboard. There's an old saying in transpersonal psychology that before you go beyond the person, you first have to be one.
Right.
And I think that's just what you said in terms of the patients who come to you, sometimes with a hypertrophied sense of self and then sometimes with a very atrophied, anemic sense of self. It takes both.
Well, it's usually the people who have been the caregivers who come for therapy, the ones who are really kind of encrusted by their egos. They don't think anything's wrong with them. They think something's just wrong with the world, so they don't seek out change.
Yep.
Well, they overgive to a point where they physically can hurt themselves and mentally hurt themselves.
The caregivers.
Yeah. Right. So now that you've had this book out and you've talked to people all over the world and been on many different programs, are people accepting and embracing the one mind or the unity of the people on the earth, and how much are you noticing change?
Well, I'm happy to say that the change is unmistakable. We are moving in the right direction. You know, none of this change goes as quickly as many of us would like to see it go. But I think we have passed the point where we see that we're not going to be able to persist in our ways of siloing ourselves off from everybody else. It just doesn't work. It's terribly destructive. Back 30, 40 years ago, talking about what you and I are talking about was just absolutely taboo. It just didn't happen. And the idea that spirituality could become a factor in health and illness was not even on the table. But in the last few years, we have seen almost all of the medical schools in the United States adopt formal coursework in their curricula, which focus on the role of spirituality in health outcomes, and many of them actually focus on the experiments showing that people can actually, by their compassion and empathic thoughts toward other things, affect the physiology of distant people, even when those people don't even know these people are trying to help them. I think that's an enormously positive step in the right direction. I often have the chance to talk to groups of physicians about these issues. I'm reminded of a talk I gave to a group of Harvard docs who wanted me to talk about something different. And I thought, I'll talk about my own experiences with premonitions. And so I did, and I told them about how premonitions entered my life in medical situations. And then in the Q&A session, they began to respond to me by telling me their experiences. And this was really something. One woman, a female internist, stood up in this group of hundreds of docs and said, "Well, I get numbers in my dreams." She said, I see the exact values of my patients' laboratory tests before I even order the tests."
Don't you love it?
I thought that was pretty good.
Yes.
And then, you know, almost all of the physicians, before they would talk about their experiences with intuitive knowing and premonitions and so, they would start their revelation by saying something like, "Well, I've never told anybody this before," but, and then they would, you know, go ahead and reveal their most private moments. I came away from that experience thinking it's really healthy to be able to give these doctors permission to share these extremely important events in their life without feeling that they're going to be judged or put down or something. So for me, it was a teaching moment. I realized that these are extraordinarily common ways of knowing between doctors and patients, and a lot of people just aren't talking about them out of fear that they'll be ostracized.
Well, it's huge. I mean, it feels like it's the wave that is moving into our future. Hopefully, this will take over.
Yeah.
Yes. And Greg had an interesting experience getting ready for this interview. You want to share, Greg?
Well, I had two, but I'll tell you the first one. I was reading in your book about how you started writing the book, and you had coyotes come and stare you down through the window.
Yep.
And bobcats and all that stuff. And right,
yep,
as I was reading that, a big red-tailed hawk, you know, they have, 5 foot, 6 foot wingspan, comes flying across the valley and comes and sits on this tree. I'm getting chills right now thinking about it. This tree right where it's near the deck, and it sits there looking at me. And then a couple minutes later, one hummingbird flies up, and then another hummingbird flies up. And so here I'm surrounded by these animals as I'm reading your section where you're talking about writing your book and connecting with nature, which is also the unity part of it too.
And right now, we're talking to you from our home in Evergreen, Colorado, and there's a family of deer that has been in our front yard all morning, and they're there now. We've got Mama, Papa, two babies, and Auntie. And so they're here sharing this experience. So
it's talk about the one mind. I mean,
exactly.
you guys are tapped in.
We love these animals, and we loved reading about how you did too, how you had those experiences. And then yesterday, Greg, share what happened yesterday.
I love synchronicities and coincidences, and I teach a lot about that in teaching about intuition. And so yesterday, the little screen on the car ran just kind of blanked out, and so I called, and they said, "You got to get down here right away, or it's going to basically blow up, and you'll have to replace your whole unit." So I hurried down to we have a Subaru dealer, and I talked to the guy, and we get done explaining and writing down the names and all that stuff, and I turn around, and there in this car behind me is a friend of ours who's also an intuitive, who doesn't even have a car, and he's driving this Subaru right behind me, and he looks at me, and I look at him like, how did that happen? Out of all the times to connect, it was to give me reinforcement because I wanted to have some experiences in this conversation with you, and that was yesterday. So out of the blue, the car acts up. I go down there. I see him. He doesn't even drive a car, but he's driving this car to get it serviced. So there you go. Fantastic synchronicity on how everybody fits together. So
well,
it was fun.
Beautiful.
Yeah. It just shows how it is all connected.
So what would you say, and there's a lot in your book about different ways to connect with the one, not connect with it, we're already connected, but more of how to enhance that connection or to get the garbage out of the way to have that connection be stronger. And so how would you tell our listeners to do that? Because I know you go away in the wilderness to reconnect and get away from distractions, but what would you say are the top five things that maybe you should do to connect with the one?
Well, I certainly don't think one needs to go to the wilderness to do it because that can be hazardous. It's also expensive, and it's hard to pull off a disappearing act.
It's hard, you know, yeah, it's hard to disconnect.
In the summer season, I have a pretty simple-minded approach. I mean, I don't think it's difficult at all to tap into this sense of oneness, one another and with the universe. I just have a four-step process I recommend. First of all, turn off your cell phone. Second is sit down. Third is just be quiet. And the fourth is pay attention. You know, if you look at the spiritual traditions, almost all of them emphasize methods of putting your conscious mind out of the way. And this can be very difficult the first few times you try it, but it becomes easier and easier with practice. All of these methods of tapping into this one mind framework involve liberation of the unconscious so that our innate wisdom can somehow filter up into our waking conscious awareness. And we can begin to operationalize it and put it to work and live with it and feel friendly toward it. So people can, I think, make up their own methods, but basically it comes down to liberating the unconscious and learning to pay attention about what crops up.
So I think that pay attention is so important. I call it being in the now or in the moment, and I'm assuming that that's the same thing.
Absolutely.
Because we live so much in the past or in the future that you miss the moment. We had an experience where we were coming out of the parking lot, and I was thinking of where we were going. So I was in the future, right? And yep. So I'm walking across the parking lot, and then Ann, who's right behind me, she looks down and she finds a dollar bill. So she was in the moment, saw the dollar bill. I was in the future, walked right over it. So
you guys make a great team.
See, it pays off to be in the present. Literally.
I mean, just to turn, like you said, turn off the cell phone, sit down, be quiet, and then be in the moment. And I always say the magic happens in the moment. It's, you know, to be there and to just watch things that are happening around you. So I think that's a great way to connect with the one mind.
Well, I liked what you said, Larry, about wandering with a sense of wonder.
Yep.
Could you describe that a little?
Well, wandering, I think, frees up the sense of wonder. You know, for me, this is not just talk. My wife, Barbara, and I have put this to work for many, many years. I can't imagine a better way to do it than to head out into the wilderness and be on your own and just let the world speak to you. One thing that you really understand very quickly in the wilderness is that you're not in charge. I mean, you're there to adapt, and if you get into conflict with nature, it's pretty clear that nature always wins in the end. I mean, you're there almost on invitation. And so it's a chance to put your ego aside and learn to fit in. I think this is a crucial lesson. We have learned to secede from nature, not cooperate, and get along. And we're paying the price. You know, this business of being quiet and letting things just filter up from the unconscious was emphasized by the great poet Mary Oliver, who has won a Pulitzer Prize and is one of the great-selling poets in America currently. Her recommendation was, first of all, be astonished, and then secondly was pay attention, and then the third was kind of a re-entry into the world. She said the third process is go tell about it. So pay attention, be astonished, and go tell about it. I think it's a pretty good recommendation for anybody who's interested in their own personal psychological health as well as the health of the planet.
Right, and then you'd also mentioned Angelus Arian, who, you know, is since passed, but she was a great mentor of mine as well. And she said, show up, be present, and tell the truth without blame or judgment.
Yep.
And that's pretty simple thought.
You know, I think we get into trouble when we make this too complex because actually it's the way we are. It's how we were intended to be. We don't need to invent something that is not already present. We just need to learn how to allow it to manifest in our life. I think if people were to open up and pay attention, as you did, to the animals and to the dollar bill and to the red-tailed hawk, I think people would be astonished about how this information is always beating on the door of our consciousness, wanting to be noticed. And all we have to learn to do is to access that. And I don't think it's as tricky as it's often made out to be.
And there seems to be a lot of people that don't connect the dots. And I think that's why your book is so good, is because you're saying, look at the little things and look at the connectivity. So somebody could say, oh, you just found a dollar. Well, it's bigger than that.
Yep.
It's the connectivity of everything and how it all works together that's the magic. And if we just let that happen and let people know that that can happen, then they're going to get more of that one mind.
Well, I completely agree. You know, one thing that has encouraged me along these lines has been the opinion of some of the greatest scientists in the 20th century. I'm speaking of the great physicists such as Max Planck and Erwin Schrödinger, David Bohm, who all believed that there was an underlying sense of unity and connectedness that just simply is part of the way the universe works. And if we don't recognize it, it's because we're just being blind to it. The fancy words that are used to describe this connectedness these days is the term non-locality and the associated term entanglement. But if you look at the experiments that have been done in the laboratory, not just in physics but in basic biology, it's not difficult to demonstrate this oneness and unity all over the place. And it's just astonishing that we have become blind to all of this and chosen instead to follow a materialistic point of view where we describe patients and people as separate and non-interacting. It's really a shame, and it's the greatest challenge I think humans face in reinstituting this concept that we're basically connected. So I just want to emphasize that we're not talking just about people's experiences, although those are the starting point, and they're incredibly important. We're also talking about experiments. And it's important, I think, to realize that our experiences do not contradict the experiments in the laboratory. They confirm them. So we're really in a good space, I think, as far as human beings go. Never before in the history of humanity have we had such an avalanche, a flood of actual data and experiments confirming our intuitions and our own experiences.
Well, what I have seen intuitively is that the world, the oneness, looks like a man's paisley tie. You know how the Paisley works and it kind of goes around, or you could say it's like a kaleidoscope that's
sure.
constantly moving.
Yeah.
And when we're in flow, when we're with the one and loving others and being kind, it's like the river flows downstream with a bunch of logs in it, but all the logs, they make their way down. You could say the logs are like the little individuals, and they keep making their way downstream. But when people are unkind or controlling of others, when they're trying to control, let's say, a population through government, through religion, through just, you know, family dynamics, then the logs get jammed. And it could be that it takes a while for the logs to really get jammed and get thrown to the side. And it could be it takes quite a while for them to get unjammed. Yep. But I see it as the controlling aspect, which you could say is the darker side of things, people wanting to control others versus allowing them to have free will. And, you know, if you're in your own little universe and you're just managing your universe, you should be allowed to do so. If you go over and try to manage somebody else's universe, that's when there's a log jam.
Right.
And it's just whenever I get out in the world and I see somebody, like there's more road rage these days, and you see somebody just being very nasty to somebody else in their car, I keep reminding myself, okay, chill out, Anne. You know, he's going to create his own log jam, and then he's going to have to deal with it. And it would be nice if he dealt with it soon, because, of course, as being part of the one, his log jam is going to affect other people. But if we can allow him to have his own log jam so he can learn from it, it helps me at least recenter and be nice to the guy who's yelling, screaming, and cussing at somebody else.
Well, that's a beautiful example. You know, one way I think we can put this oneness principle to work is to keep in mind that it gives us therapeutic options. It's a way of helping the world become better. For example, I'm thinking of all of the studies in distant healing and distant intentionality, sometimes called distant prayer studies, because that's the form that some intentions take. There are meta-analyses now of hundreds of studies showing that people who are compassionate and empathic can actually affect for the better the physiological situation of people who are at a distance. So we can put this oneness to work by helping people. You don't do that by becoming competitive and mean-spirited. You do it through compassion and caring and love. You know, one of the people who has been instructive for me is Alice Walker, the great American novelist. She said once that anything we love can be saved. And for me, this is a principle that we don't put to work frequently enough. If we're unhappy with how things are going, use your intentions to manifest a better outcome in things. So we have a method that's part of our nature about helping improve things and making them more peaceful and holistic. And we need to learn how to use that.
Right. And then the trick is to love someone and allow them the space to be themselves as well.
Because, one of the tricks that I bump into is that I find it hard many times to love people who are not very lovable.
Right.
And that's a particular challenge. In our culture today, when a lot of things are not very lovable that are going on at a national and political level.
Right. And that's where I just keep telling myself, you know what? They must need a moment to learn the hard way
yep.
in order to become enlightened.
Well, that's very generous of you. I'm
I do my best, Larry. I do my best. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of stay positive in a lot of cases, but that's where we have to support each other and be out there talking and showing by example of how to do this.
That's right.
Right. Love with respect for another. Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this is great, Larry. So anything else you'd like to share?
Well, I think one of the great contributions that this idea of the one mind makes to human welfare is that if you follow the logic of the one mind, what you see is that there are no boundaries between minds. That's what we've been talking about. And there are no boundaries in time, not just with respect to space, but if something has no boundaries in time, then it's immortal and eternal. So I think this idea of the one mind points toward a way of thinking about human survival even beyond bodily death. Consciousness that is truly non-local with respect to time is immortal and eternal. And I think this is an antidote to the fear that when people die, that's equivalent to annihilation of everything that is you. I think the one mind idea gives us hope that that's not what happens. Consciousness being without temporal boundaries lasts forever. And so I think that this view of immortality is the correct one, and that the fear of destruction with physical death has been hugely overdone, and particularly in Western cultures. And I think the idea of the one mind gives us a way of going beyond that.
It totally does. We, as part of our private practice, we talk to those on the other side. And I've been talking to people who've passed since I was little in my head. And so, you know, you go to a funeral and everybody's supposed to be sad, and I understand it is exceedingly sad to miss somebody physically. But the spirit, I mean, they'd be chatting away in my head at the funeral and sharing how it is on the other side, and it's always been so comforting to know that they are still there. And we talked to somebody just yesterday, you know, their pet, they had to put it down. Mm-hmm. And it was very sad. But then when we saw the pet, as soon as he was on the other side, he was sitting there, he was ready to go into action, to be there with her, to help her go through a surgery process, actually. And the connectedness is so huge. And once you kind of feel that and you get that, it can totally make a difference to people in a hospital or just in life.
Yep.
You know, it's the everything continues, which feels really good.
I agree, totally.
Yeah. Well, this is great, Larry. We've really enjoyed this. And anything you want to tell people about? What are you coming out with, another book, or are you just enjoying life in
well,
the
I'm
oneness?
I'm enjoying life, and I'm also coming out with it.
Okay, you're doing both.
Good.
Good.
You can do both. That's fine.
Multitasking.
I'm working on a book now of quotations that I have collected over 40 years, which have been important for me on my path. They have to do with the growth of consciousness, the nature of our own minds, and environmental issues as well. And so this book will probably be out in about a year. The tentative title of it is Vital Voices. And so this is a collection which I think would be helpful to a lot of people on their path, as it has been for me.
Wonderful. Well, they will look forward to that. Now, your website, that's DossieDossie.com, is that right?
No, actually, I've changed it. It's LarryDossieMD.com.
Got it. All right, so people can find your new information there. LarryDossieMD.com. Great. Well, thank you so much, Larry. This has been a wonderful
You guys stay in touch, and let's do it again sometime.
We will. We will. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.